Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Belgian police revealed Friday they found the fingerprint of a fugitive suspect in the November 13th Paris attack during a search of a Brussels apartment. Belgium's federal prosecutor's office said that investigators found Salah Abdeslam's fingerprint and three handmade belts that could have been used to carry explosives during a search that took place last month. They also found traces of explosives inside the apartment. A spokesman for the prosecutor's office said it was not clear when Abdeslam had visited the apartment and did not explain why officials waited a month to announce the discovery. A suspected U.S. drone strike Friday killed at least 17 Islamic State militants in eastern Afghanistan. Officials and residents said it occurred shortly after the extremist group beheaded seven people in the same area. The violence occurred in the remote Achin district of Nangarhar province, which borders Pakistan. The volatile district is where IS is believed to have set up its strong bases. Provincial governor spokesman Ayatollah Khojani told VOA that six Taliban insurgents were among those beheaded by Daesh, the Arabic acronym for IS. He added that while the executions were being carried out, missiles fired by an unmanned U.S. aircraft hit the area, killing 17 Daesh fighters, including several key commanders. Sources tell VOA the beheadings took place in the afternoon, shortly after Friday prayers in front of local villagers. This is VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama is defending his new gun control initiative as a step towards saving lives while respecting the constitutional right of Americans to own a weapon. But Obama said during a town hall meeting Thursday, the powerful gun rights group, the National Rifle Association, is attempting to derail his message. Obama said the NRA is perpetuating the conspiracy that the federal government is trying to take away someone's gun.
I respect people who want a gun for self-protection, for hunting, for sportsmanship, but all of us can agree that it makes sense to do everything we can to keep guns out of the hands of people who would try to do others harm or to do themselves harm.
The president said loopholes in the current system do not keep someone from buying guns in one state without a background check and reselling those guns for a profit. The U.S. economy had a net gain of 292,000 jobs in December, a sign that the world's largest economy is growing at a solid pace. Friday's report from the Labor Department says the unemployment rate held steady at 5% for the third straight month. The data shows that wages grew at a tepid 2.5% over the past year. The job gains are far larger than most economists expected, with business services, construction, healthcare, and restaurants adding tens of thousands of workers. The mining sector, which includes the oil industry, continued to shed jobs due to low oil prices. After two sudden price drops that triggered a circuit breaker and shut down trading this week, Chinese stocks drifted in and out of positive territory Friday, but closed up at the end of the day. The mechanism to halt trading is intended to calm markets, but its use this week seemed to have an opposite effect. Chinese officials then suspended the circuit breaker rule late Thursday. During a volatile first week of 2016, China's stocks lost roughly 10% overall. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un received an irritating birthday gift Friday when South Korea resumed critical loudspeaker broadcasts along the border area. South Korea says the broadcasts are a countermaneuver to Pyongyang's recent nuclear test that Seoul says violated an August agreement. Opponents of the loudspeaker broadcast say the tactic does nothing to help the two sides work through their differences. In response to the noise, North Korea's military has increased the number of troops deployed along the border. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight on the English Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Higgs Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
We received 40 patients in regards to related to bomb blast.
That's Ahmed Mohamed Mahat, medical team leader for Doctors Without Borders. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Human Rights Watch says at least 140 people in Ethiopia's Oromo state have been killed by security forces during anti-government protests.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Doctors Without Borders recently started a trauma surgery unit at its hospital in the northeastern Nigerian town of Maiduguri. The group says the purpose of the unit is to treat victims of recent attacks by ex-Boko Haram fighters who are now calling themselves the Islamic State's West Africa province. The MSF medical team leader in Maiduguri, Ahmed Mohamed Mahat, tells Ricky Shryock the growing number of internally displaced persons arriving in the Borno state capital mean there are increasing medical needs in the area that MSF is working to fill.
So Umaru Shehu Accra Modern Hospital is located 10 kilometers away from the heart of the city of Maiduguri.
And you guys have recently started trauma surgery at this hospital, is that correct?
Correct. We are doing trauma surgery at the moment in that facility. We are supporting.
Because this just started recently, this trauma surgery. Did you see a need, and where is that need coming from?
Because previously there is one trauma center supported by ICRC in State Specialist Hospital. We have seen that it is serving one part of the city, and then we wanted to decrease the congestion in that hospital. So we opened up the service in Umaru Shehu to cover the needs of the other part of the city.
What are those needs?
So we received 40 patients at Marusha in our accident and emergency unit on 27th around 9:40 p.m. And then among them, 16, we discharged 12 of them because they had minor injuries. We admitted 24 patients to the surgical department. We operated on 13 patients at the moment.
And that was due to a specific attack on the 27th of December.
On 27th, there was an attack in the city, so I'll not comment on that. But we received 40 patients in regards to related to bomb blast.
Have you had any more trauma surgery patients since then?
Previous, there was. But this is recently, this is the high number of patients we received in our trauma department.
Do you think this is a population that, outside of people like MSF and ICRC, it's underserved in terms of the medical needs, especially urgent medical needs?
Previously, there was a high urgent, there was an increased urgent need in the camp. Now the camps are now becoming stabilized. So we are still, there's still people moving in. There are more IDPs moving into Maiduguri from Adamawa State. And from other liberated areas into Maiduguri at the moment. So still there is still need, and we are working on it to make sure that we will help in whichever way possible.
MSF has said that on the 28th of December, when you received all these cases, there were actually quite a number of children who were injured.
That's correct. We received 16 of them under 15 years.
Right now, are you seeing that the need is increasing for medical care in Maiduguri, or is it decreasing?
With the increase in number of IDPs, with the movement of IDPs into Maiduguri at the moment, nowadays it is increasing on daily basis, coming from Adamawa states and also from other liberated areas. There's still need for us to be here, and in some of the camps, they still need some interventions. So we'll try as much as possible to get involved in areas that need our attention.
That was Ahmed Mohamed Mahat, medical team leader for Doctors Without Borders. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Maiduguri, Nigeria.
Human Rights Watch says at least 140 people in Ethiopia's Oromo state have been killed by security forces during anti-government protests. However, the government has confirmed only 5 deaths since the protests began in November. The HRW report adds that many more were injured in what they call the biggest crisis to hit Ethiopia since the 2005 election violence. Human Rights Watch spokesman Felix Horn says Ethiopian forces are treating demonstrators and opposition politicians with an iron fist. He called the development a dangerous trajectory that could put Ethiopia's long-term stability at risk. Opposition groups say the protesters are mostly students and farmers of the Oromo ethnic group, while the government describes them as extremist Oromo groups and armed gangs. The protesters have been demonstrating over plans by the government to develop farmland outside the capital Addis Ababa into a new business zone. The protesters say the government's planned expansion will lead to a loss of autonomy and the marginalization of the Oromo people living on the outskirts of the capital. The capital is surrounded by Oromo land. Oromos are about 40% of the nation's population. The government argues the plan to develop the farmland will bring new business and will benefit all groups.
For the first time since the conflict in South Sudan began in late 2013, President Salva Kiir has apologized to the South Sudanese people for the suffering they have experienced. Speaking at the opening of the ruling SPLM party's extraordinary convention yesterday, Mr. Kiir said the apology was necessary to make room for reconciliation, truth-telling, and justice. Charlton Doki reports from Juba, the convention is being boycotted by two factions of the SPLM.
President Kiir says the SPLM convention is the right place to apologize to the South Sudanese people.
To sincerely apologize before the people of South Sudan. And because of the unnecessary and unbearable suffering you, the people of South Sudan, and our beloved country have gone through in the last 24 months.
Mr. Kiir says his apology was necessary to kickstart reconciliation and healing in the Wotan nation.
Which is an important step for all of us as one people and one nation, to reach out to each other and reach a point of harmony and unity within ourselves and with our neighbors, so that we make this extraordinary convention to be the historic and turning point at which to launch the process of national healing, forgiveness, truth and reconciliation.
President Kiir says the two-day convention will ensure that the SPLM reunification agreement is incorporated into the party constitution. The Arusha agreement states that the South Sudanese leaders should apologize for the atrocities committed and all of the suffering caused by the fighting. Representatives of the former political detainees and the SPLM in opposition, the other two factions of the SPLM, did not apologize but did speak at the convention yesterday. Deng Alor, who represents the former political detainees, said implementing the Arusha Agreement is the only guarantee for SPLM unity and peace in South Sudan.
I want us to implement the Arusha Agreement as it can. Without this agreement, the future of South Sudan is going to be different. Whatever structure that you come up with will never work. It's SPLM that unites our people.
Alor's concern was echoed by SPLM in opposition chief negotiator Taban Dengai, who says the convention should have been delayed until armed opposition leader Riek Machar returns to Juba.
So that we use this forum to send a message again to the people of South Sudan and to the supporters of SPLM that once again we have met our fences, we are one body again, and the SPLM is again united. Because it is in this city, the other hall, which is just next to us here, the Nyakurek Center, where we live in 2013.
That's where leaders disagreed over party reforms and how to vote in party elections during the SPLM's National Liberation Council meeting in December 2013. Hours later, violence broke out in the capital, which quickly spread to Unity, Upper Nile and Jonglei states. The party's acting secretary-general, Gemma Nunu Kumba, says this convention is meant to pass the party constitution and manifesto so that the SPLM can be registered as a political party in South Sudan, according to the Political Parties Act of 2012. January 15th is the deadline for registration. It's not clear if the SPLM-IO and former political detainees will accept the outcomes of this convention, which they are not attending. Former political detainee Alor and SPLM-IO official Guy only spoke at the opening ceremony. The convention ends on Saturday. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
The United Nations Refugee Agency reports thousands of people in South Sudan's western Equatoria state are fleeing from growing violence and criminality. The outflow adds to the already huge problem of displacement both inside and outside this conflict-ridden country. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency calls the violence between armed groups and government forces in western Equatoria state particularly alarming because the region until now has been relatively stable. South Sudan's two-year-long civil war has produced one of the world's largest humanitarian emergencies. More than 2.3 million people have been forced to flee their homes, including some 650,000 who have sought refuge in neighboring countries. Besides the localized fighting among warring factions, UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says an apparent breakdown of law and order in and near Yambio, some 300 kilometers west of the capital Juba, also is causing people to uproot themselves.
Sporadic gunfire has become commonplace. There's also been an increase in crime involving sexual assaults against women and children and girls, carjackings, attacks on government property, looting of civilian homes, reportedly by youth. There was a recent UN mission to Yambio, found that nearly 200 houses were burnt down in the neighbourhood of Ikpiro, which is in the north of the town. Several hundred others were looted. People have taken refuge in the town centre in Yambio or moved to nearby villages.
The UNHCR estimates that 15,000 people have become displaced in western Equatoria's state since heavy clashes broke out in the region's capital early last month. The agency reports the violence is also causing people to flee across borders. Since the beginning of this week, it says about 500 refugees have been arriving in neighboring Uganda every day, a quadrupling of recent numbers. Refugees say they also are fleeing because of a shortage of food due to failed crops. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Two former prime ministers will face off in the Central African Republic's presidential runoff election set for January 31st. Provisional first-round results released late yesterday showed Anicet Georges Dologwele leading with 24% of the vote, followed by Faustin Archange Tudera with 19%. More than 30 candidates ran in the first-round election on December 30th. Despite threats of militia violence in the capital Bangui and other rural regions, the National Election Authority said turnout for the much-anticipated vote reached 79% earlier this week. A group of candidates called for the vote count to be canceled, citing alleged voter fraud and logistical difficulties. But the Election Authority dismissed their concerns as invalid. The CAR is holding presidential and parliamentary elections to replace a transitional government put into place in 2014, a year after rebels ousted longtime president Francois Bozizé. Dologwele, 58, is an economist who was prime minister under Bozizé between 1999 and 2001. Tuadera, also 58, is a former math professor who served as prime minister under Bozizé from 2008 until 2013.
A suicide truck bomb in Libya has killed 50 police recruits at a college close to the city of Misrata. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the attack comes as the Islamic State terror group continues its assault on oil facilities in the east of the country.
Around 400 mostly young police recruits had gathered Thursday at a training college in the town of Zlitin when the suicide attacker struck. One of the policemen described what happened. He said the attacker drove through the gate very fast in a large truck and then the bomb exploded. Local residents helped ferry victims to hospitals in nearby Misrata. It is Libya's deadliest bomb attack since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Such attacks have become more frequent in recent months. Islamic State militants claimed Thursday to have captured the strategic coastal town of Bin Jawad. But risk analyst Riccardo Fabiani of the Eurasia Group argues the group's expansion in Libya has been limited.
The problem for IS in Libya is that they cannot really exploit religious, sectarian, let's say, divisions as they have.
In recent days, IS militants have launched attacks on major oil facilities in Es Sider and Ras Lanuf, resulting in huge fires.
Their strategy here is to attack these facilities, damage them. Why they're doing this right now, it's quite clear, because there is a peace deal, there is a national...
Libya's rival administrations, one based in Tripoli, backed by Islamist groups, and the other internationally recognised government in Tobruk, signed a UN-negotiated power-sharing deal last month, but they are yet to form a unity government. The UN envoy to Libya, Martin Kobler, is calling for Libyans to back the deal and unite against terrorism. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The death toll in the suicide truck bombing in Libya has risen from 50 to 60 dead. All victims were police or police trainees. An Islamic State affiliate known as IS Barka Province has claimed responsibility for the attack. The group tweeted that the driver detonated the explosive-laden truck when he drove into the center of the police training center. Meanwhile, another Islamic State affiliate in Cairo claimed responsibility for yesterday's attack on the Three Pyramids Hotel near the Giza Pyramids. The blast damaged the facade of the hotel and broke windows and a bus that was parked nearby. The group claimed they left many dead and wounded, but the government says no one was injured. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 23 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Doctors Without Borders recently started a trauma surgery unit at its hospital in northeastern Nigeria to treat victims of recent attacks by ex-Boko Haram fighters. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports thousands of people in South Sudan are fleeing from growing violence and criminality. And Human Rights Watch says at least 140 people in Ethiopia's Oromo state have been killed by security forces during anti-government protests. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Conservation scientists say advocates of huge hydroelectric dam projects on some of the world's largest rivers overestimate the economic benefits while underestimating the threats they pose to biodiversity and rural livelihoods. The concern was raised in a study that appeared in the January 8th issue of Science magazine that highlights the threat dams pose on the Amazon, Congo, and Mekong rivers and their surrounding communities. Leandro Castello is assistant professor of fish conservation at Virginia Tech. He studies how global change affects the ecology and conservation of fish and fisheries and is also co-author of the study. He spoke with me about the impact of dam projects on rivers and the people and wildlife that depend on rivers for survival.
Well, they highly disrupt the ecosystem in which these people rely on for their livelihoods. For example, changes in habitat and river flows by dams cause enormous changes to the fish populations that these people rely on for their primary source of protein, also as sources of income and livelihoods as a whole. Their livelihoods depend and are essentially adapted to a way of living, which is highly impacted by these hydropower projects.
What are some alternative solutions where people's lives are not disrupted?
I think there are ways to minimize the impact. There is no question that we need to increase the capacity to produce electricity. But the ways in which we have been, you know, constructing hydropower projects to produce electricity, we are convinced they are not the best ways. If a greater array of information were used at the time of constructing these dams, we are convinced that there should be ways to minimize the impacts and, you know, produce electricity, satisfy people's needs while minimizing the negative impacts. There's a strong history and a strong record that basically when the hydropower projects are proposed, their benefits look great. And 10, 20 years into after the dams have been built, those benefits are usually much, much lower than what they were advertised at first.
Can you give us some examples where these hydroelectric dam projects have threatened rivers and the life along rivers?
A clear case that is happening right now is the Belo Monte Dam in Brazil in the Xingu River of the Amazon. The dam is being built in an area of very, very high biodiversity in terms of species of fish. There are several indigenous tribes and local cities living in the region. Many of those people live and depend on exploitation of ornamental fishes, and they're building the dam right in the area. So the area is going to disrupt the traditional ways in which these peoples have been living to produce electricity. So when you look at the projections of electricity production, those projections, there are full of uncertainties. And there's good reason to believe that the total electricity production will be much less than what they have been advertising so far.
What is the first step then in negotiating with people who are building these projects, these dams, in terms of how do you get it started that this is the effect that it's going to have in the environment?
I think the first place to start would be to include stricter policies in the process that leads the construction companies to start these dams. If you implement more rigorous legislation that has, a more stricter set of requirements, we should be able to produce electricity, which we need, while minimizing the impacts on people and the environment.
What happens to people when they are forced to move because of these projects?
All sorts of things. Their lives change dramatically. I'm sure in some cases for better. In other cases, not for better. It's hard to predict. The question is, you're really affecting people's lives. I believe it's hard to predict that those changes are always for the better, as largely advertised by the construction companies and the governments that are behind these hydropower projects.
That was Leandro Costello, assistant professor of fish conservation at Virginia Tech. He spoke with me from Blacksburg, Virginia.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Doctors Without Borders recently started a trauma surgery unit at its hospital in northeastern Nigeria to treat victims of recent attacks by Boko Haram fighters. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people in South Sudan are fleeing from growing violence and criminality. And Human Rights Watch says at least 140 people in Ethiopia's Oromo state have been killed by security forces during anti-government protests. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, a Malawian band is nominated for the Grammy Awards. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya's Buhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have kudos for a Gabonese footballer.
Kim, here's a sunny side of sports salute to Gabon and Borussia Dortmund striker Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who was named the 2015 African Footballer of the Year in Abuja, Nigeria.
The winner is Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang.
The 26-year-old Aubameyang has been banging in goals in Germany's Bundesliga. He's currently the league's top scorer with 18 goals. And since joining Dortmund in 2013, he's scored 47 goals overall. Aubameyang also captained Gabon's team at the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Equatorial Guinea. The Gabonese did not impress in Equatorial Guinea, though. Aubameyang scored a goal in Gabon's opening match, a 2-0 win over Burkina Faso, but that would be his only goal, and Gabon lost its next two games and was eliminated after the group stage. Because of that, some thought Manchester City man Yaya Toure might win a record-extending fifth consecutive African Footballer of the Year trophy since his Ivory Coast team lifted the cup in Equatorial Guinea. The vote by African national team coaches and technical directors was close. Aubameyang received 143 votes, while Toure got 136. Andre Dede Ayew of Ghana and Swansea City was third with 112 votes. Our VOA football fans will remember Ayew's father, Abedi Pele, was a three-time winner of the African Footballer of the Year award. Speaking in French after winning the award, Aubameyang said beating great players like Toure and Ayew is a real thrill.
Quand tu es à côté de joueurs comme Yaya Touré et André Ayew, c'est une fierté de gagner ce trophée devant eux, parce que ce sont des très grands joueurs que j'admire évidemment beaucoup.
When you have contenders like Yaya Touré or Ayew, said Aubameyang, it's quite a big achievement to win such a trophy because those are great players. I have a lot of admiration for them. Meanwhile, Yaya Toure expressed disappointment over not winning again.
Quite disappointed, but I don't want to complain too much. You know what I mean. I just want to give you credit as well to Bayo Bernabeu. You've been doing brilliantly well this year, and Andre Ayew as well is quite a little bit disappointed as well. You know, and what we have to do, I think, from now, we just have to play football to play, and try to do it our best.
Ivorian football star Yaya Toure speaking in Abuja, Nigeria. Marco Uma joins us now with the other winners at the African Football Awards ceremony in Abuja.
Cameroon's Gaëlle Engana-Mowit is the Africa Female Footballer of the Year. Tanzanian Bwana Ali Samata scooped the Player of the Year based in Africa accolade, while Frenchman Harvey Renard is Coach of the Year. Nigerian striker Victor Osimhen is Young Player of the Year. His teammate Ogenekaro Etebo bagged the Most Promising Talent of the Year award. African champions Ivory Coast are the National Men's Team of the Year, while Cameroon are the National Female Team Award winners. The Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe was named the Club of the Year. Ghanaian Charles Giamfi was conferred the Legends Award posthumously. Cameroon's Samuel Mbappe also received the Legends Award. Somalia's Abdi Kwani Said Arab was named Football Administrator of the Year. Senegal's Football Supporters Club Alaise Kassa bagged the Fair Play Award. Gambian Bakari Gassama was crowned Referee of the Year for the second year in a row, while the Nigerian head of state, Muhammadu Buhari, received the Platinum Award. Meanwhile, hosts Uganda play Gabon in Injeru, some 80 kilometers east of the capital Kampala, in a friendly match on Sunday. Rwanda hosts the Democratic Republic of Congo in Gisenyi. Elsewhere in South Africa, Angola face Guinea in Johannesburg as Nigeria engage Ivory Coast in the capital Tshwane. These are build-up matches ahead of the African Nations Championships starting in Kigali, Rwanda next week. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Because this is a Africa, Tami Namina, Waka Waka, Tami Namina Sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Ni chabulile.
Hola. Cause this is Africa, Tami Namina, Waka Waka, Tami Namina Sakalewa. This time for Africa.
Mark Ouma mentioned some of those friendly build-up matches for the African Nations Championship, or CHAN, which kicks off January 16th with two games in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. Rwanda will host Ivory Coast, and Gabon will go against Morocco. For more on the three-week tournament, let's turn once again to our African football guru, David Legg.
Well, this is a unique competition in that it's restricted to home-based players. So, for example, if you're a Rwandan and you're playing in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you're ineligible. You must be playing in Rwanda. Similarly, as a Nigerian, you must be playing in the Nigerian leagues to qualify. And the reason for this, Sonny, is the president of CAF is a hired two. He felt some years ago that the local players were really playing in the shadow, so to speak. The Nigerian team was composed almost exclusively of overseas-based players, and that the local players were not really getting a chance to shine on the international stage. So I think this is a good initiative by CAF. It began in 2009 in the Ivory Coast with the first tournament. It was won by the Democratic Republic of Congo, a team that included Kidiaba. In 2011, it moved to Sudan, and it also went up from 8 teams to 16, which is where it stands now. The second tournament was won by Tunisia. They beat Angola 3-0 in the final. The third tournament was in 2014 in South Africa. And again, a real fairy tale finish here with Libya. Despite all their security problems post Muammar Gaddafi, they emerged victorious despite the fact that they only won one of their six games. The other five were drawn. They won the quarterfinal, semifinal, and the final against Ghana, all on penalty shootouts. So we've had a fair amount of drama, and I think Rwanda will be no different. The first thing, and a very important issue with Rwanda, is that the head of state, President Paul Kagame, is a very keen football fan, and he's right behind this tournament. Sonny, we often hear in Africa of this official and that official and this politician backing the tournament, and they're going to do this, that, and the other. But in actual fact, they do very little. But Kagame is an exception to that rule. He gets personally involved. He has said that he expects it to be a successful tournament, and I believe it will be. And Rwanda, to me, this is a stepping stone towards hosting the Cup of Nations itself. What the little Central African country has done already is host the African Under-17 Championship and the African Under-20 Championship. So they're doing it step by step. Now comes the CHAN. And if they are successful with that, I believe it's long overdue for the Cup of Nations to go to East Africa. The earliest that can do so is actually 2025. I know that the Ethiopians are interested, but I think the Rwandans will officially, sooner or later, become interested. And if they can host this CHAN tournament well, successfully, get good crowds, and we have limited problems, I think they're going to be a strong candidate. On the football field, though, Rwanda are going to find it very tough. They're in Group A with Morocco, Ivory Coast, and Gabon, and that's a tough ask. Only the top two will qualify for the quarterfinals. Nigeria failed to qualify for the first two CHAN tournaments, and in the most recent one in South Africa, they finished third. They beat Zimbabwe 1-0 in a playoff to get the bronze medals, and they will certainly be among the teams to watch. They're in Group C. They're up against Tunisia, who I think will probably be their strongest opposition. They're up against Niger and up against Guinea. So there's a distinct West African flavor to that group. If you then look, Sunny, at Group D, this one is difficult to call. You've got the two Zs, Zimbabwe and Zambia. You've got Uganda featuring the 18-year-old Farouk Mia, who I'm never tired of mentioning on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
A very promising player, one to watch. And then we've got Mali, and this is a tough one to pick. I'm going for Uganda and Mali, but I could easily be wrong with both my choices. Finally, we've got Group B. It's Angola, Cameroon, the Democratic Republic, and Ethiopia. And for me, the two teams that stand out here are Cameroon and DR Congo. DR Congo and Zimbabwe, incidentally, the only two countries that have qualified for all four editions of the CHAN, which carries a $750,000 American dollar first prize. And that's certainly money that's not to be sneezed at. So essentially, Sonny, with this CHAN, we're looking for plenty of goals and plenty of good football on the field. And off the field, we'll be watching with great interest to see if Rwanda can keep up their reputation for being very good organizers of CAF international competitions.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.
I encourage our VOA listeners to check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog. The address is blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Once again, that address, blogs.voanews.com/sunny. My latest blog post is titled Ghana's Comey, Fighter to Watch in 2016, and I write how Richard Comey is hoping to add his name to the list of world champion fighters that Ghana has produced. The undefeated Comey, who fights in the lightweight division, is in line for a world title shot, possibly later in 2016. The International Boxing Federation says Comey will fight in a final elimination bout for its world title. The 28-year-old Comey is a power puncher, and his career results reflect his hard-hitting style. He's won all 23 of his pro bouts, and only two have gone the distance. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, for the first time ever, a Malawian band has been nominated for the Grammy Awards. And not just any band. This is a little-known music group in Zomba Maximum Security Prison. Their project, I Have No Everything Here, was recorded in prison in January. It's been nominated for the Best World Music Album. Lamech Messina meets the group inside the prison and checks out a performance.
The Prison Reform Band was created in 2008, largely to entertain inmates at Zomba Maximum Security Prison. This was in addition to the Malawi Prison Brass Band. Acting Chief Commissioner of Prisons Litu Dinizulu Ntengano says the band came into being when he bumped into a group of musical young prisoners.
When I visited the Zomba Central Prison, I saw some boys playing local made guitars from empty gallons, and they could play music. And once they started playing music, there was an attraction of prisoners coming out from their cells to listen to this music. And I said, no, let us improve this.
He proposed funding from the National AIDS Commission for the musicians to start composing songs about HIV/AIDS awareness messages.
They gave us 500,000. We bought 3 electrical guitars, a set of drums, and a very small speakers. Oh, the guys were very happy. And we started composing HIV/AIDS related awareness campaign music inside the prisons.
This led to authorities giving the band additional funds to buy more musical instruments. A prison officer, Linus Kaunda, is the deputy leader of the band. She says the Grammy nomination was a surprise to everyone at the prison. She says the band was surprised when an American man came to record their music and they were suspicious of his motive. She says they did not know what he wanted to do with the recordings or where he wanted to take them. She said the band only allowed him to record because it was an instruction from authorities. Band member Ernest Kufandiko was sentenced in 2009 for theft. He said the nomination confirms that a prison is a reformatory center and not a dumping ground. He says the general public should not expect the band members will be leading their previous lifestyle when released. What they should know is that the convicts have learned skills that once released, they will know that these young men have indeed changed. The 20-song album was recorded in 2013 by visiting American Grammy-winning producer Ian Brenner, who later gave it international exposure. The 16-member band is up against 4 other acts: Lady Smith Black Mambazo of South Africa, Angelique Kidjo from Benin, Gilberto Gil from Brazil, and Anushka Shankar from India. Prison authorities say the band will not attend the February award ceremony in Los Angeles. Instead, they say a government representative may go on its behalf. But whoever represents them, the band members say they will win the award. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Zomba, Malawi.
The sexual exploitation of children through rape, commercial sex, pornography, and other means is a crime almost everywhere in the world. But every continent faces its own challenges in the arrest and conviction of the perpetrators. In the final part of our series on the sexual exploitation of children, VOA's Adam Phillips looks at why access to justice is often denied for those who are underage.
In 2014, ECPAT, a coalition of groups fighting the sexual exploitation of children in 83 countries, initiated an ambitious Access to Justice project. Interviews with major stakeholders, including child victims themselves, revealed several ways in which access to justice can be stymied or denied, especially for kids who had been forced into sex work through trafficking or economic necessity. To begin with, says project advisor Darlene Lynch, these children are often treated as invisible by police.
The police simply are not
searching and rescuing these children. They rely very, very heavily on NGOs to do that work, and many times will turn a blind eye to the child and do not rescue them as they might another child who's victimized in another way.
I asked Sheila Varadhan, who heads up ECPAT's legal programs, why this is so.
The real reason is the police, if you talk to them, will say these kids are difficult. These kids want to be there. These kids voluntarily are on the street. So what we need to do is make them realize, okay, these are difficult children to deal with, we understand, but they deserve to be legally visible. They deserve to have police come up to them and ask them, are you okay? Do you need help? Do you need protection? Are you safe?
The Access to Justice study found that when police do come across a child, he or she is at great risk for being treated just like a willing adult sex worker rather than as a victim. But the African Charter for the Rights and Welfare of the Child defines a child as anyone under 18 without exception. It guarantees strong safeguards and protections for children. And Sheila Varadhan says children cannot legally consent to their own exploitation.
More often than not, especially if they're boys, there's a perception that they're there because they want to be. And the reality is they're not there because they want to be. They're there because they don't have any other options. I mean, if you would ask a child who's living on the street if they would prefer to live at home and go to school and have someone pay for their shelter, or to engage in sex, which in exchange gives them that basic sustenance, I would say most children would prefer the former. If you could get someone to really look at these kids who are on the street and give them the compassion they deserve, I think that would be a big step in the right direction. Those children deserve to be listened to.
Children will not be heard where talk about sex and sexual exploitation is off limits. Varadhan says that in African culture, as elsewhere, these subjects are customarily viewed as strictly private matters.
So an idea of a child coming forward and accessing a very public government judicial process, like a government institution, is frowned upon. And the child won't have access to that. The family often won't support that. There'll be a lot of pressure at the initial process to settle the matter rather than take it through the formal judicial process. And a lot of countries in Africa, a lot of the outer regions don't even have prosecutors or formal criminal process. They still rely on informal traditional practices. So structurally, there are a lot of barriers.
Darlene Lynch says that many children hesitate to enter the legal system precisely because they don't have the emotional support a family can give.
Either they're separated from their families because they've been trafficked, or their families are abusive, neglectful, or simply just don't understand that earning money by having their child engage in sex is harmful and illegal. And a lot of states do not provide alternate types of support for these children either. It's not guaranteed that they'll have a lawyer or a guardian ad litem or someone else.
But a bigger impediment is often simple fear.
After they make a decision to go forward, these children almost routinely receive threats, intimidation from exploiters to drop their case. And witness protection programs are pretty weak in these cases. So that's another unique and really terrible barrier in these cases. Another barrier is failure to provide adequate therapy for these kids. A lot of them have suffered tremendously. And in order to go through a really grueling criminal justice process, they need help, they need medical care, they need psychological care. And in many countries, this care is provided in locked residential facilities that to a lot of children feel very much like a prison.
Children who stay the course must often wait for years for their case to be heard. Many have been given little information about their case and inadequate representation when their day in court does arrive. Many have lived on the street and are drug addicts or diseased. This makes them unappealing witnesses. In addition, the court requires exploited kids to repeat detailed accounts of their abuse, often in the presence of their abuser. This can be extremely traumatic. Jusuwai Tuka is the founder and director of Kawade, a rescue and relief agency for prostituted children in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And she says that at the end of the day, families may not welcome their children back out of shame.
Sometimes they even acquire some money from the children, like you were there, you were working. Where is the money? We want to buy a car, we want to make a milling machine. And young people, they don't want complicated kind of situation when they want to return home.
There are efforts by ECPAT and its partners to help sexually exploited children gain access to justice. These include decriminalizing prostitution for children, sensitization workshops where police and judges can meet with young victims, and awareness education campaigns where children learn that it's their human right not to be exploited or abused. Darlene Lynch acknowledges that these strategies have produced disappointing results so far, but it's a fight that she and all those who care about children are certain to continue. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering rewards for information leading to six key leaders of the Somalia-based terrorist organization Al-Shabaab. The U.S. Secretary of State has authorized rewards of up to $6 million for information on the whereabouts of Abu Abeda Diriya, up to $5 million each for information on Mahad Karate, Ma'alim Daoud, and Hassan Afguye, and up to $3 million each for information on Ma'alim Salman and Ahmed Imam Ali. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has killed thousands of civilians, aid workers, and peacekeepers in Somalia, Uganda, and Kenya. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the July 11, 2010 suicide bombings in Kampala, Uganda, which killed more than 70 people, including one American citizen. Al-Shabaab also claimed responsibility for the September 21st through 24th, 2013 terrorist attack against the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, which left more than 60 people dead and nearly 200 wounded, and the April 2nd, 2015 attack on Garissa University College in Kenya, which resulted in 150 deaths. The U.S. Secretary of State designated Al-Shabaab a foreign terrorist organization on March 18, 2008. In February 2012, Al-Shabaab and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network jointly announced they had formed an alliance. Abu Abeda, also known as Diriya, was named the leader of Al-Shabaab on September 6, 2014, after the death of former Al-Shabaab Emir Ahmed Abdi Al-Mohammed, otherwise known as Godanye. Mahad Karate, also known as Abdirrahman Mohammed Warsameh, has played a key role in Al-Shabaab's assassination operations in the April 2nd attack on Garissa University College. Ma'alim Daoud is responsible for Al-Shabaab's planning, recruitment, training, and operations against the government of Somalia and Western targets. Hassan Afguye oversees Al-Shabaab's financial activities, ranging from fake charities and fundraising to racketeering and kidnapping. Ma'alim Salman leads Al-Shabaab's African foreign terrorist fighters and has been involved in attacks against tourists, entertainment establishments, and churches in Africa. Ahmed Imam Ali has recruited Kenyan youth and raised funds for Al-Shabaab. Anyone with information on these terrorist leaders should contact the nearest U.S. embassy or the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net. Individuals in North America can call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. VOA. Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.